I said we're going to talk about communication without words. And I think one of the best ways is to try this a little bit right in the group here. And I've done this many times, and it kind of goes dead, you know, if someone's going to try to get up and communicate in front of the rest of you. That's kind of difficult. So we'll try it a little differently this time, and we'll break off into threes. If you want to be technical, it's triads, but I like threes better. And each of you try to think of something that you can communicate to another person in the group without words. And when you've got something, you know, you can raise your hand or some way indicate it. And when two of you've got that, then the third one is the observer. And one communicates to the one, and the other one communicates. The third one can come back, I mean, when we come back together in a few minutes, can tell us, well, now this is what I saw them communicate without words. I don't know how this will go, but we'll find out. Huh?
Well, there's a feeling of, you know, what's this person looking at me for? But without saying anything, yeah.
I think you're saying that a facial expression and a glance told you quite a bit. Okay. That's interesting because you see a lot of what we saw around here was kind of a homemade sign language. You know, not quite the normal type of nonverbal activity. And that's not the right word, but not the typical type of nonverbal activity. Okay, who else saw something that they'd like to share? Yes.
I became more conscious of these two persons. Before we were just all conscious of the whole group. But when I came to this, I became conscious of these people as over against everybody else.
All right.
And it became more reality.
Okay, good. And this, in a sense, speaks to the effect of dialogue. It was a type of dialogue with the two fellows on your right and left. And you then know them better now than you did beforehand. Okay, fine. Any other comments? You have tried certain things, and now let me open some doors to show you the multitude of nonverbal communication signs which I see and which I'm sure you see but aren't always conscious of. Bill, can you come over here for a minute? And we're going to, even though you can't see, well, I'm going to shake hands with him in a couple of ways. First, this is going to be a receiving line, a reception line, see, and he's number 12 coming through here. Well, how did you feel? Kind of a fast shuffle,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Hi, goodbye.
Yeah, it did tell you something. It told you that you were going through a formality, I believe, but that you really weren't important as far as the person in my thinking. At least I wasn't giving him any time to speak of at all. Now, I had a stepfather-in-law, and he would shake hands like this. Are you ready?
I guess so.
You know, I mean, what do you think he was saying?
I don't know how much of it was.
He would pull. Anybody?
Mighty glad you're here.
Yeah. This is, you know, that's just exactly what Hilmer Guttormson was saying, you know, by his handshake. It was, you know, he shook hands, and particularly if he was seated and you were standing, you know, that was kind of dangerous because you had to kind of brace one foot, you know, and then you could shake hands on a man-to-man basis with him. But he was saying that. I'm glad you're here.
What happens if you're both that glad that the other?
Well, I haven't found that too much, Sharon. Well, then there's another way, you know, other ways of shaking hands, and I'm not saying anything at all, you know, but taking the other hand and putting it on top of his hand. Do you feel a little differently?
Yeah.
Or even, you know, whatever it is. It's the touch, the human touch, the uncommon touch, whatever it is. But I would hope that if I did this to Bill or to any of you, you see, that you would know that I was saying more than just kind of a, you know, a quick clammy handshake. You get a good grade on that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. But just think about your handshake. And it's easy, I mean, to think about other people's handshakes. I mean, there are some that are almost a cold fish. And there are some that are real warm. And there are some that are almost encompassing. Someone said the other night, you know, the arms were made to encompass people with. And I was commenting about some people I've known when arms, I think, are made almost to, you know, keep at arm's length with. It's a different use of the same thing. I had a principal when I was in high school, a student, and he would get attention from the assembled students, and of course that's no easy task when you got 2,000 sitting out there. But if this is the audience out here, he would get on the stage and stand sideways, put his arms akimbo on his hips, and stare at us, you know, right over his shoulder, kind of, you know, like this. Well, you know, it was nonverbal communication, but it didn't say the right thing to me. And I later became one of those individuals, and I was always careful to try not to give this type of an impression, because it was purely nonverbal. But he didn't give a friendly appearance. In Washington, D.C. recently, the dean of a very famous university, we were in a meeting, and he finally went like that, you know, and he got up and he stalked out of the room and slammed the door. He didn't say a word. But I don't think there was any doubt, you know, about his nonverbal communication in the group. It was very evident. I think of a principal friend, and he was in a sensitivity group that I was in. And finally, the people said to him, "You know, Bill, I'll bet your staff knows exactly when to quit pressing you and when to back off when you're, you know, having a discussion with your staff." And he said, "What do you mean?" "Well," they said, "we've noticed every time when you kind of get pushed into a corner, your neck starts to get red right here and goes right, you know, right on up to your ears." And they said, "I'll bet, we'll just bet your staff, you know, okay, you know, we've gone far enough now." And that was his kind of a message. He probably didn't know it. And this is sometimes the reason it's helpful for us to talk to other people, you know, about some of the nonverbals that they may give us. Because we all want to be the best possible person we can be. But we give off signs sometimes that we don't know about. And there is a risk in telling somebody. But nothing is gained if you don't risk now and then. And I, from my experience, if you make 8 or 9 out of 10 good receptions to trying to help someone along this line, I think it's worthwhile. Specifically, I think of a teacher we hired where I was superintendent one time. Very fine person, excellent credentials, but about 3 different people in there wrote, "So-and-so gives the appearance of being aloof and distant and disinterested in other people." Well, you know, it just didn't stack up with all the fine comments about his teaching ability, you know, how the students reacted to him and so on. So after the contract was signed and all, I said, "Chuck," I said, "do you want to know something that might be helpful to you, how some other people react to you?" And he said, and this was risking, you see, on my part, because the risk I saw is maybe he won't like me anymore. Maybe not so much that he'd get mad, but maybe he won't like me anymore, a personal risk, and we have to realize that. But he said yes, and so I said, "Well, 3 people," and I didn't say who it was, "have indicated this type of a statement." Well, he was mad and glad, both. He was mad because no one previously had taken the time or become interested enough in him, you see, to say, "Do you know that I get this impression from you?" And so he'd been, you know, bumbling along doing this. Whereas now he was glad and he appreciated it and he could make a change and did this, you see. So nonverbals can be something we consciously do or something we unconsciously do. And we can help others sometimes by kind of checking out and saying, do you know that I get this type of an impression from you? How do you communicate to a baby that you love it? Okay, you know, kind of hold them tight and rock them and say all kinds of silly sounds, you know, to it and such as it. And then how does a baby tell you, you know, it respond? Probably smiles and gurgles and looks happy when you come, you see, but it doesn't say a thing. It's nonverbal. And you to the baby, largely nonverbal. What do you communicate when you go to church and you wear clothes like you're wearing now? Well, that's another type of nonverbal, and I guess I shouldn't have thrown it in, but it, I guess it disturbs me sometimes because, you know, I kind of feel like if I don't meet a certain style pattern, you know, McCall's number 72 or something, that I'm not fit for worship or some such thing in church. Maybe you haven't thought about it, but anyway, I think the fact that we wear certain style of clothes to church is a type of nonverbal communication to others, you know, who may come if they didn't have these clothes or who just like to come as they are, but would feel, you know, quite conspicuously different if they did. So that's, we're all engaged, I suppose, in that nonverbal communication. When I was in high school, I had a girlfriend who would wink a lot. And, you know, I've mentioned this several times, and everyone leaves me in complete ignorance. I'm not sure what she meant to this day, but this was nonverbal communication of some type, I guess. What about glances? What about glances, of, you know, at a wedding? The new bride and the groom. Boy, there's powerful nonverbal communication. And then, what about the glance at some social event of maybe a wife to a husband, you know, something that just kind of pins them right to the wall, you know, right there in front of everybody. Nothing is said, but it's a powerful situation. What about laughing at people? I refer to that as a little article I'd written once about chiseling on your spouse. I think every time that we laugh at, rather than kind of build up or have communication with someone, we're kind of nicking away a little bit, you know, at a person's self-concept. Chiseling away, that's the way I mean chiseling here. Chiseling away until, you know, maybe there isn't very much left after a while. Not a great deal of self-concept. And I'm sure that I could trace, if I had the time and the money, a study that would show, you know, that in a husband-wife relationship, where one in little ways kind of built up the other person throughout life, as opposed to, you know, other couples where in little ways, and non-verbally usually, one kind of nicked away at the other one, you'd find two completely different sets of individuals that, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years later, and largely through nonverbal communication. When you join an organization, in a sense, this is nonverbal. I remember joining a union, I didn't even have to do that because I was working for a newspaper many years ago. And things were kind of poor, and we threatened to join a union. We got together and talked about it, and things improved, so we didn't. But you join a church. I suppose that's really no verbal communication or no nonverbal communication if other people don't know about it. When you go to communion, this might be nonverbal communication. To whom you're willing to sell your home, you may not say much. But if you limit, put restrictions of this type, That says a whale of a lot. Last year in a group like this, there was a John Rondema family, and the son came up to the mother, I know, and asked for, well, two things happened. The mother and father were sitting like this. Son, I'm guessing, was 8, and he came up and to his parents, and the dad just, you know, he reached out and put his arm around him, you know, and patted him or something. Didn't have to, you know. It was nonverbal communication. Said, son, you know, I like you. You're important to me. He asked his mother for a dime, and instead of, you know, reaching in, getting a dime and giving him, she took out her coin purse, you know, and she just gave him the coin purse. She was saying something else to me rather than just, you know, yeah, I like you enough to give you a dime.
I trust you.
Yeah. You know, here, take my purse. I trust you. Lots of little things going on like that all the time. I think of spanking. I don't know if any of you ever received one of those. And I think of someone I talked to the other day who said, when spanked, this person refused to cry. Refused to cry. Well, that's a message too, you see. You can't break my spirit, and so on. There's a lot being said that way. I understand that about several years ago, when some hikers came into the village, they had been gone a long time, had a long hike or a rough hike or something like that. People knew they were coming in. They met them out here at the wall with basins of water. You were here?
I heard about it.
Okay. I don't know who was here, but with basins of water and towels. Is that right?
Yeah.
And they washed their, they took, set them down, took off their shoes and socks, washed their feet. Pete was one? Washing or hiking?
Washed.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, how could you possibly tell those people that you cared for them in any more effective way? You know, if they come in and say, we like you, we're glad to see you back, that's fine. But doing something is a strong type of communication. I think of another foot, the foot of a board member, Dick Richardson, in board meetings. And it gave him away, really, because whenever Dick Richardson had an idea, and he had good ideas, his toe would start to, you know, it'd bend like this. And I could look across and see his toe starting to shoot, you know, twitch like that. And I could almost say, well, let's hear what Dick Richardson wants to say, you know. It was a symbol and a sign which he may not have been aware of. We have a relative that's in a private home, can't speak at all, and we don't know whether she can hear much. And yet when my wife goes there to visit and holds her hand and says some names, that hand squeezes her hand. That's the extent, you see, of the communication, but it's quite meaningful at that point. The Dukhobors in British Columbia, you may have know something about them. I am told that they have something against getting too rich, getting too much worldly possessions. And if one of the Dukhobor brothers kind of goes off the deep end and is looking a lot at his worldly possessions, some of the rest in the community will get together and decide to burn down his barn. To bring him back, you know, to not worshiping at the reality of, or the idea that things are this important, things are. Well, that's nonverbal communication. I guess one that I could do without, but it's pretty strong. What about the sit-ins and the riots? I think, you know, if words are ineffective, we find a lot of this going on. And back in Washington, D.C., about two or three summers ago, they had a lot of their rioting there going on. And it wasn't just the burning that impressed me, if that's what the right word is. It was a selective burning. You could go down the streets, and this building in the block was burned, and the next building was saved, and so on, you see. And by nonverbal communication, those who were doing the looting and the burning said, you know, these people practice good personnel practices. For example, a new Safeway store, the people formed a human chain around it and kept it from being damaged. That was nonverbal communication. But someone who had been exploiting the people in the community received another type of communication that day or that night. What about suicide? I don't know much more to say other than ask the question. I have in my file, I didn't bring it here, a letter from a student in school who was writing to his teacher and saying that others picked on him some. People thought he was different because he didn't salute the flag, because he didn't celebrate all the holidays that others celebrated and so on. And on the backside of that is a news article of his suicide, of his taking his own life. He had written to a teacher, and I'm not blaming the teacher one bit, you know. I mean, I don't know what you do always. You do get letters of this type. You do get talk about this in school, and you never know, you know, what is for real and what isn't. And I don't mean you downplay it at all. But it doesn't happen too often, but it's a jolt when it does. And you wonder to what extent lots of people are being driven if they have to communicate in that fashion. And I think about the hate maybe that is being expressed or communicated in assassinations. And we've seen much more than our share in this country. And then I guess maybe the ultimate of nonverbal communication would be laying down your life for somebody else. And if at this point we're thinking of Christ, or if this point we're thinking of somebody out in one of the world wars or wars that we have who may throw himself on top of an unexploded grenade to save others, he's saying a whale of a lot more than I've ever said. For example, well, we have trouble monitoring our nonverbal communication. In other words, when you talk, you can hear yourself. You know, you monitor what you say right away. But the nonverbal, you see, I don't know how I'm coming across. I can't monitor it. You can. And on this basis, sometimes you can be of real help and real assistance in communicating with others about how their nonverbals might affect you. You may or may not think about this, but where you travel, I don't care whether you're in a school, in a community office of some type, in a church, in a business, in a home, where you travel in that particular situation says a lot. The people you don't talk with, the people you pass by, the people you may ignore for some reason or another and with whom you're not having dialogue, you're saying something to them about their importance. To whom you're available, if you're a businessman, for example, your secretary can say a lot for you too by who she makes available to your office. Or if someone comes to see you, where do they sit? And this is particularly for the men or women who work in offices. Do they sit across the desk from you at a distance? Or do you bring them around to the edge where there is no barrier physically between the two of you? And when someone is in with you, are you answering the phone? Are you looking at the clock?
Are you looking at the door when someone goes by? And all of these things, giving signs, you know, that, well, yeah, you're here, but so are a lot of other things going on at this point. Well, let me get back to a few things from the Miracle of Dialogue, and we will have an official closing before 3, because I think other things are going on in which some of you may be interested. And then I'll just be here for a while until 3:30 anyway. In the event some of you want to throw questions, make comments, and so on, you're certainly welcome to stay. As far as Howe's book is concerned, there are two sections that I want to refer to. One is a preface, where he says, all of us, in one way or another, are trying to communicate or get into significant touch with someone. And all of us, to some degree, are baffled by the failure of our attempt. Now, I don't know whether you are baffled by the failure of your attempt to try to get into touch with or communication with other people. I know I am, and Reuel Howe says he is, and maybe some of you are. And for those that are, you have quite a bit of company. The other portion I'd like to share with you is this section here. Many ministers, and I don't think the word ministers needs to hang in here. I think it'd just be many people, although he's referring to some who come to an institute with which he's involved. Many ministers who come to the institute confess that they are concerned because when they speak, they do not say anything. And when they listen, they do not seem to hear anything. That's why I'm confident this applies to teachers. It applies to parents who may say to somebody, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, you know. And somehow or another, the listening, communication isn't there. Because the possibilities and the perils of communication are so great, we naturally ask the question, who shall deliver us from deafness and dumbness? How shall the issue be determined on the side of dialogue? The New Testament tells us very simply that Christ made the dumb speak and the deaf hear. We all want this miracle of dialogue, to happen to us. And then on the next page, the principle underlying dialogue is, he who loses his life for my sake and the gospel shall find it. This means that we enter into a dialogical relationship not for the purpose of gaining, and this is too easy to try to get into it for the purpose of getting something, but for the purpose of giving, with the prayer that we may lose our pretensions, we may lose our masks, we may lose the armor that we put around us, such as this, and we may lose our defensive need to justify ourselves. And I don't know if this is a challenge for many of you or not, but that hits me right between the eyes, that we to lose our defensive need to justify ourselves. That just got my initials right in the middle of it. And gain a reassurance of life by having it affirmed in our relationship with another. So the purpose of what Reuel Howe has here is to help us to talk with others in a manner of dialogue and be understood, but maybe more so, to listen to others. Because there is a ministry of listening that says, I care about you enough to take the time to listen. And it may be somebody who's not too interesting at first. It may be somebody who looks like the least interesting person you could find anywhere. But looks are deceiving, and you have to test. And nonverbally, when you list, you're saying, I care about you. And someone has said that studies have shown recently that a lot of psychiatry is not needed if people who are now paying to have somebody listen to them could find somebody who really cared enough to spend the time to listen. So today, with the nonverbal communication without words, we're talking about a communication of action, a language of action, more powerful in words because we're talking about love, we're talking about care, about appreciation and courage and willingness and this type of thing. Okay, we have a few minutes before 3 anyway. How about some help from you?
I have a question I'd like to ask you on this particular statement that you said had your initials written in it. I'd like to know how you grapple with that. I mean, how do you approach that?
We're talking about the need to be defensive. I have even a hard time approaching it and grappling with it. I guess that's my first honest statement. Secondly, I suppose the person with whom I'm being defensive is the one that I've got to dialogue with about it. And many times this will be my wife first. I suppose the ones closest to us, at least this seems to be my experience, that it may be the hardest to be honest sometimes in that situation. So I need to say, well, gee, I'm really on the defensive here, and I realize it, and I'm sorry. And I'm sure that defensiveness with my children, who are now older and gone, but this is also a real problem. And I think the dialogue. And I'm not leaving dialogue with God out of this, but I think I've also got to get to the person involved.
Isn't it extremely hard to be just absolutely honest with yourself?
Why, yes, it is. There's nothing easy about dialogue, I guess. Or at least, I shouldn't say that. To some people, dialogue looks very simple. And someone said to me yesterday that they thought I had dialogue easily with people. And I just said, you don't realize I'm interested in this topic because I don't really have an easy time of it. You know, this is one of my interests. So if anyone finds it easy, I think they're a very gifted or talented person.
Well, I think one thing for me about dialogue that's so hard is that when we do expose ourselves, we're so apt to get hurt. You know, if you do reveal that you are ill at ease, or you reveal something about yourself, and someone gives you the brush off or turns the eye away, like you said, they may be talking to you, but you know you still open up their watch or something. And then that makes it all the harder again to maybe do it another time.
Mm-hmm. There is, in addition to being difficult, there is the risk, which you're talking about, of being open. And I don't think a person goes out, you know, and meets somebody on the street and say, you know, like this. That's the ridiculous extreme. But there are people that you trust. And there are people probably in greater percentage at Holden Village that you can trust, maybe than anywhere else you'll ever be. And what I'm really saying is, if you hesitate to venture into openness, your chances of success are far greater here in being received and accepted for what you are, I think, than anywhere else. And that's why I think it's an important topic here, and I would encourage this openness. Because there's nothing more exhausting than being insincere. And I don't mean I strive to be insincere, but it's natural, you know, to put this mask up and to have you think, this is me.
Have you been working on some often? I mean, for example, Powell has an amazing way of putting it. But I mean, facing this head on is a very conscious effort of doing something about it. something that you've been confronting yourself with for a long time?
Yes, I don't know, a long time, maybe, you know, 4 years, something like that, if that's long.
Are you winning?
I'm not where I was when I started. I'm ahead, if you want to look, ask that way. I guess maybe it was a little longer than that. I've been to several of the, you know, these other interpersonal relationship sessions, and one of the startling things happened about one of the first summers we came up here, when our communication, even within the family, was such that I had a real blow when I found out that, well, maybe my wife wasn't really interested in coming up here, and here we were in the car on our way. Now, I guess I'd have to get better than that, wouldn't I? Only one way to go. That's rather a quick, brusque statement. It may not be quite, you know, the way it sounds, but in effect, communication, even with people you're very close to, can be something that can come apart, it seems.
Couldn't that be an intended situation? I speak as a wife of somebody that I don't agree with all the time. But many times, I'm sure he's not aware that I really didn't want to do what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing it because he wants to. I don't know if he really wants me to do it. But, sometimes you can do it, and you can fool.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be perfectly
honest about it. Yeah, but he got behind her mask.
Yes, there's give and take, but I
but to give in a way that is not intended to be a giving.
Uh-huh.
See what I mean?
I guess
not to be known. You're just doing it because you want to do it, and not because you want your husband to know that you're doing it because you want to do it.
When we can take it out and go through the semi-traumatic experience of being honest and getting all this thing, it's a little rough at the time, but when it's over, we really know each other and where we stand and have respect for each other, and I think we're on a far better plane of communication. I feel this way from our experience. It really hurt me to think that, a vacation is quite a major thing, you know, and to find out along the way that maybe we weren't really in agreement on this was quite a blow.
Well, why would it be? If she was doing it because she wanted to do it, because you wanted to do it.
Yeah, well,
I
cared about her enough to want her involved, you see. And I was so, blind to this whole thing, I hadn't even seen it.
But as you say, if she resented it, this then to me puts it in a very different situation. Because if she's doing it because she thinks she has to do it, then there, I feel, there's resentment. But if she's doing it because she wants to do it, then I don't think there's resentment.
Well,
because none of us does what we want to do all the time. And I think that a good part of our living is giving without the pat me on the back thing.
But when you do, I don't know that you can resent or have these things happen and not resent it. It's difficult anyway. And I guess what I'm saying is that when I am filled with some resentment and I don't say it, the signals come out somewhere down the line that something's wrong. See, and so we're not working on the gears aren't meshing. We're grinding gears about every time. It's kind of like having some disagreements and not working them out. It's kind of like having a landmine under the rug, you see, and you agree in the family, you're not going to step on that spot. You're going to stay away from it. And then if you use this technique, pretty soon you don't know where to walk. Because you got landmines all over the house, you know. These are the forbidden taboo topics. And if you can resolve them, not so that you're both saying, oh boy, we're both 100% happy, you know. But if you can arrive at some agreement on this, and if I can at least know what her feelings are and respect them that much, and she know my feelings and respect them that much, we might find we're not far apart, you see.
You talked about being on the defensive. What happens when you know someone very well, and this could be a husband, it could be a child, and you know yourself that in order to reach some point of communication where things start happening, that you have to deal with subjects in which this person is terribly defensive. And yet, you know, to get so that person can even cope with his own defensiveness, how do you do it? You see what I mean?
Oh,
where you know
yes, I do.
You reach the stage yourself where you know that this is a sore point with that person. But to get past some kind of a hurdle, you've got to come to grips with that sore point. What do you do?
We've done that before, an experiment here at the village. And we did it where we said to our spouse, are you ready at this point to have me tell you something that is very important to me? And the spouse at that point sat and thought for a while and looked at himself and said, you know, can I handle what I think she's going to talk about? And if he said no, then the subject was dropped. But usually, if you will examine yourself and say, okay, at this point I'm not going to be tense and I'm going to try and take it, then it's okay. But what usually happens is that we end up dragging that thing up and we're trying to hurt somebody.
Well, women are filing cabinets of hurt.
I'd never heard that before.
It really works.
Does the women's lib subscribe to that?
Yes.
Is that right?
The women in there are crystal.
Oh, okay.
Do they have a corner on that? I don't understand. Maybe if we explain that. Women are filing cabinet at first.
Well, they store them away and drag them out at the proper moment. Something the husband has forgotten or thought he's forgotten, she pulls out at the moment and just pulls all the props out from under him because he thought they had established that long ago and had settled it.
Why do you do that?
Just the way women are. They're women are cataloggers. I suppose, but I mean,
that explains a lot, doesn't it?
It happens, but I think it happens, you know, I hate to see you become masochistic in
a... No, this isn't original with me. This is just something I've read in the book, and I think it's true in many ways. I really do.
There was a question you raised a little earlier, and I don't know that we got at it satisfactorily, and that was on how do you deal with somebody who is about something in where he is very, or she is very resentful.
It could be your boss, it could be a fellow teacher, you know, it could be anything like this.
Well, you know, if it's someone who works for you, that relationship maybe is a little easier.
Yeah.
If it's your boss, I suppose it's harder. But it seems to me these things get the stickiest right in the immediate family.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the experience of others.
It seems to get past from that you both have to agree that the relationship between you is important to each of you, too. Often, especially in parent-child relationships, when a child is trying to establish independence,
mm-hmm.
and the child is denying the importance of the relationship, that's when it can be worse.
Mm-hmm.
With a spouse, you can kind of say, hey, what's best for you and what's best for me is best for the relationship. We've got to work this out because we're both affected by it. I think this may often be harder with a child. That's what you mean. Relationship doesn't mean beans to me.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't talk with somebody who doesn't put a handle out.
It takes two to have an argument. So if you go up to it and approach it and decide that there isn't going to be an argument, there just isn't going to be an argument. There isn't going to be an argument.
So we argue.
That sounds a little bit like that lady who says, where I am, there's cooperation. Where I am, there's got to be cooperation.
It's true that the more you care about a person, the harder it is to get around such a certain agreement.
You know how vulnerable is, and you allow that person very much.
Yeah, but that's the price you pay for being open.
And
this is where I think our responsibility comes in, to not only to ourselves, but so much to other people, because Marianne and I have been through this many, many times, and I see it as a matter of a game of cards, if you please, that we exchange hands. With the confidence, you see, I give you a hand of cards that happen to be mine, and I entrust them to you to rearrange them for me and hand them back in a little better order than what I gave them to you. Now, once I've given those to you, you see, you have them. So, at that point, I am at your mercy. You see, at that point, you can hurt me. You can either hurt me, or in your ability to hurt me, you can help me. And you can't help me unless you can hurt me. Because when I leave myself open enough that you can hurt me, then is when you can really do me some good. And that's where a tremendous amount of faith and trust in the other person has to come about. And it's a bitch. There's just no two ways about it, because when you hand those cards over, you see, you're open. And you can be ripped to shreds at any moment. Now, I think at points where we become defensive, where our person is challenged, we start pulling those cards out and throwing them back at the other person, neglecting our responsibility that was given to us when we were entrusted with those cards. And that's the terrible responsibility that we have to one another, I think, when another person confides in you. Because then it's you who has the ability to really destroy. But, you know, it's so easy. It's so easy to do when you become defensive. When someone hurts you, even unknowingly, to just rip them to pieces. Our ego gets hungry, and so we consume a couple of people defeated, unknowingly, or knowingly.
This is very well said. It's a different, you know, metaphor, a different approach. I'd like to embroider on it a little bit. If you don't reach out, or if you don't give the other person the card, if you don't give them the opportunity, if you don't say, in effect, I do need help, how can, you know, you don't put out any handles, how can they help you? I liken it to, a cast iron bathtub. One of those real thick ones, you get behind that. How can anyone help you? If you're all self-sufficient, you've got no problems, and you're pretending to the whole world, you know, that everything is great and everything is fine. You can't help a person who won't be helped. And so his idea of kind of saying, you know, here are my cards, is kind of another way of saying, okay, so I've got a problem. I need some help. What can you do? And I don't know many people who then will, you know, follow you up.
It seems strange that the psychic, I'll speak to the male thing, especially in our society, the self-made man, etc., that's this rhetoric that we keep coming back to. And I find it a very hard thing to overcome, because in the process of building yourself, I am what I am because I have done it, not because of anything else. So that when you reach the point where you have to say to yourself, well, maybe in this area I am somewhat inadequate, I am lacking somewhat, is to threaten the whole structure that you have built. You can't say, now, I have this, all of these good things that have happened because of me and because of other people, and accept it at that point and say, okay, at this point I'm weak. Instead, we have to say, because I am weak at this one point, the whole structure is in question. And I think this is where the defensiveness so often comes out. I can't admit I'm weak in one place, because that must mean that I am weak in many other places, which means that this thing that I have created is really in question. And I find this in myself and also in many other people, and it's a very hard thing to overcome. And I find, for myself, this is where I become most defensive.
Had some real good points brought up here. Are there some other points that anyone would like to go in or fasten on to? Well, why don't we call it officially closed, so if anyone wants to stick around and talk, why, I'll be here for a while.